All right. I decided to bring some more cookies for this class, and I unfortunately don't have any recipes from Periclean Athens, or from the traditional Somali, or from 18th century England, which are areas that hopefully I'll get to today. But our first class was on Imperial China, and I thought that as an act of filial piety, I would bring you chocolate chip cookies made from my mother's recipe. And my mother's recipe for chocolate chip cookies differs from all other recipes in including half a cup of grape nuts along with the other ingredients, which makes it nice and crunchy. And my own contribution is the conclusion that chocolate chip cookies are best when frozen. So I brought them frozen. Whether they're still frozen now, I can't swear, but they were when I brought them here. Right. So, as before, I thought I would start with a quick review of what we did last time, take questions, discussions, and then go on to various new stuff. And I talked a bit about the Amish, who I found to be a really interesting social institution, society, that it starts in a way with the fact that the nearest thing to a unit of government is a single congregation, which is 25 to 40 households, because it's got to all fit into one big farmhouse. So it's a very small political unit system, and it is a political unit system where every unit has its own law. That is, San Jose can make some rules, but it's subject to the laws of the state of California. The state of California is subject to the laws of the federal government. The Amish don't have the power to ignore the federal government, but as far as the Amish themselves are concerned, there is no authority above the individual congregation. Groups of congregations with similar rules group themselves as affiliations, but one member of an affiliation has no authority over another. So that's sort of interesting. It's a system where the standard Amish congregation has four clergymen, a bishop, and then three lower-level ones. They are all chosen by lot. None of them are trained for the job, except that the bishop has to be chosen from those who were the level below before that, and it's a lifetime appointment. Unpaid lifetime appointment. And I was suggesting that there was an odd sense in which they're really anarchists. That is to say, you're only bound by the rules after you've promised to obey them as an adult, because they don't believe in infant baptism. That was their original heresy. And furthermore, insofar as they're governments, they are very small governments, and you're free to move from one to another as long as the other one will have you. The basic enforcement mechanism, the ultimate sanction is shunning. The ultimate sanction is a rule under which the other members of the congregation will have very little to do with you. Short of that, it's sort of a sequence of you're doing something that violates the rules, please stop it. You kept doing something violating the rules, please stop it and publicly apologize to the rest of us. And you're doing something that violates the rules, we are going to shun you for a few weeks, and then publicly apologize to the rest of us, and then finally
the bishop of one group, that group could have some rules that are different from another.
Absolutely. But it isn't the bishop. That is to say, in theory at least, the rules are supposed to be assented to by all members, because they can't do their religious ceremonies until they've all done that, essentially. So it's probably the clergy that in practice sort of say this is how we've decided to change it, but it's pretty clear that a lot of that is questionable people are doing. That if people can sort of be pushing at the boundaries, and if everyone feels it's all right, they expand the rules. If not, they say, sorry, you got to stop doing that. Yes? I believe the clergy is limited to men. I think that's correct. I think.
How about how much participation do the
women have? The women, I believe that the women's assent, I believe, is required. As far as I can tell, the women, aside from being clergy, I think have the same status as the men. Now, presumably, only adults would count, because if you're not an adult, you haven't yet sworn, yet promised to obey the rules, and therefore are not yet a member of the community. But I think, as far as I can tell, there's a pretty clear gender division of labor in the traditional system, where the woman is running the house and the man is running the farm, although women have some roles with regard to the farm as well. I don't know if men have some with regard to the house, but it sounds as though what's normally happening in the upbringing is that they only have to stay in school till 8th grade, but thereafter the daughter daughters are really being trained to run a household and the sons are really being trained to run a farm in the traditional pattern. Not all of them are still farmers, but that sort of was the traditional arrangement. Yeah?
You said that the children, the young adults, are not really held accountable until they are baptized.
Yes.
So what happens to these children or these teenagers, which is usually the age when mischief is made? What happens to them if they violate the rules of the congregation?
Nothing. That is, their parents might do something. The parents have whatever authority parents have over kids. But as far as the congregation is concerned, as far as I can tell, if somebody saw the kid driving a car, he would not, the deacon would not come to him and say, you've got to apologize and so forth, because you aren't yet obligated to the rules. You aren't a member yet.
But yet, how about if they commit a crime, what we would be considered a crime?
That would presumably be up to ordinary law enforcement to deal with, but the general attitude of the Amish seems to be that they will not report crimes, that they will participate to the extent that they are required to participate, but will not engage in any voluntary participation in the criminal justice system. Yeah.
I saw something in the news last week. There was something about that they committed a crime. I mean, a whole group of them. Something about beer cutting, and
yes.
it was tried
yeah.
as a.
But that,
that was in
our legal system. Yeah, that was a case of one group of Amish who thought other Amish were insufficiently rigorous in their
views. The discussion was about whether what the women would wear in prison. Because,
yeah.
Not that I consider prison guard particularly
yeah.
sexy, but
yeah, that is among the rules. The standard rules include restrictions on what you wear. Basically, sort of part of the Amish ideology is humility. And therefore, they don't want people competing with how nice their clothes are, and so they have all sorts of restrictions on
clothing.
But, yeah?
I read that same article, and it was said they were all convicted of doing a hate crime.
Yeah.
But I wonder, when you join that community, and that's their method of punishment?
It isn't.
Oh
no! The beard cutting was one extreme subgroup of Amish who thought some other Amish weren't behaving themselves and decided that if you're not that you shouldn't be wearing a beard and looking like an Amish if you're not an Amish, and that wasn't part of the normal. I mean, in general, one congregation has no authority over another congregation, so that certainly they were not fitting in the Amish pattern at all.
So how did they come to be convicted then?
I assume that somebody accused them, whether Amish or non-Amish. I don't know. I didn't follow the case. But that was the government legal system, not anything the Amish were doing.
It was like 15 years before.
I don't know. So as I was saying, you could think of the Amish either as extreme democracy on the grounds that nothing is supposed to happen if any member of the congregation doesn't want it to, including conviction of offenses within the system and changes in the rules, or you could think of it as dictatorship, since in practice, mostly when the clergy decides something, the membership usually goes along, but competitive dictatorship because you are free to leave one congregation for another anytime, or set up your own anytime you like. So in that sense, it's an interesting system. And part of the interesting thing about it is the history of relations between the Amish and the rest of us, who they call English, because we speak English, whereas most of the Amish, their home language is Pennsylvania Dutch, which is a German dialect. Some of them is a different German dialect, the later migrants. They all speak English as well, but it's their second language.
What do they call themselves?
Good question. I don't know. The one issue was the draft, and they generally got conscientious objector status, but there was still a problem because the conscientious objectors were being put into a very non-Amish environment for 2 years, and they were losing a lot of them not coming back. And they eventually persuaded the Selective Service System to set up farms run by Mennonites on which Amish conscientious objectors could do their war service, growing food for the war effort. Theory of it, I think. The Social Security was another problem where they were engaged in civil disobedience for a while because they felt that it was immoral to accept Social Security, that they were supposed to take care of their own people and God was supposed to take care of them, and insurance is basically a gamble and they disapprove of gambling. And after about 10 years, they succeeded in persuading the Congress to make a special exception under which Amish employed by Amish do not have to pay Social Security and do not collect Social Security. Schools were probably the biggest fight, and there the combination of the increasing required school age changes from the late 19th century on, plus the increased centralization of the system, which meant that you were going to school not with fellow farm boys, but with people from the being bused into the nearest city where you were interacting with people from a very different culture. The Amish found that unacceptable. They refused, many of them refused to send their children to school. Some of them got arrested and went to prison. They, at first at the state level and then at the federal level, they finally won a Supreme Court case unanimously, holding that they were entitled to leave school after eighth grade, provided they then essentially provided the rest of the education as homeschooling to their kids, which they were in fact doing anyway. And they also succeeded, I think, at the state level in getting permission to run their own schools, which mostly would not qualify as private schools for anybody else, given how they're run, because they're basically one or two room schoolhouses, mixed age, but nonetheless seem to work pretty well. They end up speaking both two different languages fluently, and at least they seem to be reasonably successful in leading the lives they lead. One of the reasons, aside from sort of them being an interesting institution, one other reason we might be interested in them is that there are an increasing number of them, a fairly rapidly increasing number. The total number of Amish in the 90 years has increased roughly 50-fold. That's the result of traditional family size and modern medicine. It's what we refer to as exponential growth. If it continues, that means that they will probably pass 1 million in about 40 years, pass 2 million in about another 20 years, and so forth. So they'll become a significant part. We don't know if that'll happen. But nonetheless, I think they've done a pretty impressive job of maintaining their own style of life, their own approach to things, in the middle of a very different society. So it's interesting. Yes?
Are there Amish colleges?
No, I believe, I think one of the fairly common features of the Ordnung is that you don't go to college.
Don't go to college.
I don't believe, I think that would probably be considered a violation of the normal rules in most or all congregations. Yeah. They don't even go to high school. That is basically through eighth grade and then their own system. Yeah.
Do they use fertilizers or
My guess is that they would use fertilizers. I wouldn't be surprised if they used DDT, but I don't know. That is, the point is, it isn't that they objected to all products of modern technology. They object, as far as I can tell, to those products of modern technology that a particular congregation believes are in some sense subversive of their system. So, I don't believe they even fly in airplanes. But it's a mistake to think of them as people. I do historical recreation. They aren't doing historical recreation. All right, they are perfectly happy to use a modern medicine. They're happy. Many of them are happy to have a powered hay baler on top of a horse-drawn wagon. So it's not as if they are trying. You know, we like to sort of romanticize them as 19th century rural ideal. That's not what they're doing. They're running a modern society with a different set of rules, and those rules involve constraints of which technologies they're willing to use. I went on to the sort of general issue suggested by several of our cases of what I think of as when God is the legislature. How do legal systems work when the basis of the law is not Congress, it's not a king, it's what is believed to be divine command, and I suggested that not only does that describe the Muslim, the Jewish, and ultimately the Amish, but it also in a way describes the U.S. constitutional law, because although we don't literally call the Constitution God's word, it is a fixed set of rules that are very hard to change, and that raises the same kinds of issues. And that there are then two basic issues raised by that situation. One of them is, how do you get consistency? How do you avoid a situation where this judge interprets God this way and that judge that way? And the other question is, what happens if God gets it wrong? What do you do if most of the people in the legal system believe that a rule in the divinely dictated document is in fact a bad rule? and for how you get consistency, basically there are, I think, two solutions, both of which you can see in the Jewish case, and one or both in the other. One solution to consistency is to say God's will is a fact people can disagree with about, but the law isn't. So therefore, you have some mechanism which doesn't really determine what the truth is, because people can still argue for the other side. But as long as you don't have a majority vote in the Sanhedrin, the majority's view is what you as a judge are required to enforce, even though you as a legal scholar may want to argue that it's wrong. And that was basically the initial Jewish solution to that problem. But there's another solution which is embedded, I think, in both Islamic and Jewish law, and that's to say, God told us what mechanism we use to decide which of the views of God's will is right. So in the Jewish tradition, there is a bit somewhere in Torah which says that if you are unsure of the law, go with the will of the majority. And in my view, that's been pushed way beyond any plausible reading of it, because it includes cases where you aren't unsure, where Torah is perfectly clear, but the majority votes in a different way. But that was the theoretical basis. Similarly, in Sharia, there is a hadith, a tradition of Muhammad, that he said, my people will never be agreed upon an error. And if you accept that, you can say, well, if at some point everybody agreed about something, now it's over. Now we've settled it. Now Muhammad tells us we must have been right. And that's the consensus idea, and that's more or less the basis on which many, though not all, Islamic legal scholars would hold that the gates of interpretation closed about 1,000 years ago. That by that time, they had gotten consensus on all of the important issues. So those are really two alternatives. What do you do if God gets it wrong? And there are at least two solutions to that that we observe in real systems. One of them is you interpret around it. You find some halfway plausible excuse for saying, well, yes, Torah says you're supposed to stone the disobedient son to death. But you can interpret this bit of the passage as implying it's only a disobedient son who does this. And that bit is saying that. And this bit is saying the parents must not be deaf, blind, or crippled, because they've got to take him by hand and do this and that. And so if you add in enough qualifications, you can plausibly say, yes, indeed, you have to stone a disobedient son to death, but it'll never happen, because no one will ever be. You get a slightly less extreme version of that in Sharia, where the Quran says you are to cut off the hand of a thief, but then the interpretation says, if he stole perishable food, we will assume it was because he was starving, and that doesn't count as theft. If he stole from a house where he was a guest, then what he stole was not protected, and taking things that aren't protected doesn't count as theft. If he stole from the treasury, then he may have considered himself a partial owner of the wealth of the Muslims as one of them, and stealing stuff that you think you're a partial owner of doesn't count as theft for this purpose. So there are a bunch of qualifications such that if you don't want to cut somebody's hands off, you probably don't have to. And you can then use a lesser level of punishment in a different part of the legal system. So that's one approach, and that approach, I would say, has been used spectacularly in the U.S. system, where, for example, it was held in a very important Supreme Court case that a farmer who was growing crops to feed to his own animals and his own family was substantially engaged in interstate commerce and therefore could be regulated under the farm program on the grounds that Congress can regulate interstate commerce. That's sort of my favorite example of what seems to me an absurd interpretation around, but given that at the time of the New Deal there was a strong political pressure to have farm programs and push up farm incomes by restricting output, which is what they were doing, also of course making everybody else poorer, but don't forget, by making food more expensive, which is what we're still doing, but you can see why there was pressure to interpret it in that way. And there are a variety of other, with a little effort you can find other examples. Another way of doing it, other than interpreting around, is to say, well, the divine rule applies to this part of the law. But here's another part of the law we can use to do it. So that in the case of Islamic law, you have the police courts, which is basically a court set up by the sovereign, which in theory is just implementing Sharia, but it's got its own rules of evidence, and so forth, so it can do things you can't do in Sharia. If you read Maimonides, he describes how when somebody has committed murder indirectly, hired an assassin, for example, under the law you can't convict him of murder, and so you can't execute him, but you can lock him up and not feed him very well and treat him so badly that he'll probably die. And Maimonides, being a good economist, makes the obvious argument, why do you do that? So that somebody else won't say, aha, I want to kill somebody, I can get away with doing it this way. So that would be an example of that. Examples in the U.S. system, first the use of administrative agencies to do things that the executive by itself can't do, and the most famous recent case, the conclusion by the Supreme Court that the Obamacare mandate was unconstitutional as a mandate, that it was not covered under regulating interstate commerce, as the government claimed, but it was constitutional as a tax. Which it didn't claim to be, that you were just being taxed if you didn't get health insurance, essentially. So that was a case of saying, the Constitution doesn't let you do this over here, but look, we can do it over here. So all of those are ways of doing it, all of which, trust me, is interesting. That stuff from last time. I then went on to talk about the gypsies, which are another, to me, very interesting system. Part of what's neat about the gypsies is you have a common culture that's been geographically very scattered, and therefore you've got, in effect, almost like a controlled experiment about how did the legal system develop here, 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 and here. And the gypsies came out of northern India about 1,000 years ago, scattered mostly over the Middle East and Europe, though nowadays, of course, they're in North America and God knows what, where else as well. There are a lot of them. I think the estimate is about 3 million to 15 million, and I'll come back to that number a little bit later. And all of the legal systems, as far as I can tell, have in common rules against ordinary bad behavior with regard to other gypsies, that you're not supposed to swindle other gypsies, basically. And they also have in common, with different variations, what I like to describe as Orthodox Judaism on steroids. That is a set of fairly elaborate taboos and prohibitions about cleanliness and uncleanliness, about how you can prepare food, what happens when a woman is pregnant, sex, excretion, a whole bunch of things which are visualized as sort of cleanliness, uncleanliness, and all of the non-gypsies are sort of filthy pigs who just don't understand these things and therefore are perpetually polluted, in effect, from their standpoint. But at the same time, you have quite different sets of mechanisms for enforcing the rules, with at one extreme the Blachrom, the Jews, these are the gypsies who were in Romania for 400 years, where the basic system is that if you have a disagreement that parties can't settle, you call a meeting of everybody, talk about it forever, eventually reach a consensus, and then require the parties to go along with the consensus on pain of marame, which is pollution, which is really rather like what the Amish are doing to you, although it's a slightly different excuse, so to speak. The theory being that once you're polluted, associating with you, the pollution will be contagious, and therefore until you do whatever is needed to do to get unpolluted, you're out. So it's essentially an ostracism kind of penalty. The Romanchal, the largest group of British gypsies, on the other hand, have an entirely different system, which is basically a feud system. It's basically a system where if you wrong me, I threaten to use violent force against you unless you compensate me. And the reason it's not as simple as might makes right is that everybody knows that if you really have wronged me according to the norms of our community, your friends won't back you and my friends will back me. So there's a sense in which feud systems work best when right means might. That is, when being on the right makes it easier to win a fight because more people will support you. Then there are the Kale, the Finnish gypsies, who are the weirdest group of all, because they essentially, for public purposes, deny the facts of human reproduction. They don't treat children as the children of their actual parents, but as the children of all of the women of the mother's generation, essentially, all of her sisters, or I guess her husband's sisters if they're living with the husband's family. And I described some of their institutions. I should say my source on the gypsies is a book called Gypsy Law that you can probably find if you're curious. And I don't like the editor, and the editor's chapters aren't very good, but there are a bunch of good chapters. He's too apologetic. He's too concerned with defending the gypsies rather than telling us about them, which is what's interesting. But there are other chapters by other people who are much better. I should say the expert on the Kale gypsies makes it fairly clear that he was more or less unwilling to testify in court on cases involving the Kale, because he would have to tell the truth, and the truth is they do engage in blood feud, some of which is obviously illegal under Finnish law. On the other hand, their blood feud mostly is accomplished by avoidance rather than violence. There's some use of violence, but mostly once two families are in feud, they just avoid associating with each other. And then there was an interesting theory about why you have these differences, in particular that when the Blatchram were inserted, blood feud doesn't work very well if there's no exit option, if you can't run away when the conflict gets too bad. They couldn't move when they were serfs, and therefore they switched to the other system. We don't know that's right, but that's an interesting conjecture trying to understand why these things happen. All right. I then talked a bit about the general subject of embedded legal systems, which I don't think I really finished last time, although I was starting on that, where by embedded legal system, I mean a legal system that exists under the shadow of a superior legal system. And that's true of the gypsies. It's true of the Amish. The Jewish diaspora case is a little bit different because until about the 18th century, mostly the Jewish communities, in fact, were authorized by the sovereign to apply their own law to their own members. Since the 18th century, they've been really in the situation of the gypsies, where you can use social pressures, but you don't really have an independent legal system. Then there are a variety of other examples that one could mention. We were talking before class started a little bit about the Sicilian Mafia. If you're curious about that, there's quite a good book by a man called Gambetta, who researched the Sicilian Mafia and at least can give you some reasonable idea. Yes? Because their gypsies are all over the place.
Yeah, because, and that normally they're, don't be upset with me, they're like supposed to be the pickpockets. So I always thought with
Indian, might be.
Hey, it was okay to do stuff against people who were not gypsies.
Yeah, that's true of most human societies, actually. Consider my standard example for us. Consider all the people who say they're in favor of poor people and are therefore restricting immigration to protect the American poor from the competition of foreigners who are a great deal poorer than the American poor, and who would be a whole lot better off if they came. All right, think about the difference between the conditions of the people who are willing to go through hell to get here and the condition they'll be in if they get here versus anything within the normal range of American society. So we're doing the same thing. They're foreigners. They don't count. Right? I mean, it's a very, very common attitude among human societies. Yeah, no, I think it's clear that as far as gypsy law is concerned, offenses against non-gypsies only count to the extent they get gypsies into trouble, other gypsies into trouble. So you don't want, they might try to restrict things you were doing because those things would rouse hostility to the gypsies. But I think gypsy law does not consider non-gypsies to be part of what they're protecting, any more than we consider dogs and, you know, pigeons to be part of what our legal system protects. They're not really people. Other examples of embedded legal systems. As I say, the Sicilian Mafia is one very interesting one. It's fairly clear the Mafia is not an organization. There is no boss of the bosses. There have been occasional efforts at establishing something above the family, but none of them have actually worked. The Gambetta really argues that what the Mafia is a brand name. It's a set of independent organizations with somewhat similar institutions who recognize each other, but there isn't an authority above that within it. It's an interesting book. But there are lots of other examples. I had one paper done by a student about the LDS, the Mormons. She was a Mormon, and she interviewed her bishop for the paper. And the LDS has its own legal system, underneath, obviously, the system of the U.S., but for settling disputes among Mormons and for punishing within what they can do, which is basically restricting access to the temple and things of that sort, offenses against their religion. I had another one who did a paper on prison gangs. And, of course, if you knew enough about them, youth gangs in the big cities presumably have some sort of an internal legal system you could try to study. But furthermore, I would point out that you are currently sitting in the middle of an independent legal system, namely the legal system of Santa Fe University. That each university in the U.S. has its own, typically its own courts, called disciplinary committees or some title like that, its own set of rules. And in fact, in my other seminar, which deals with legal issues of the 21st century, I encountered a very interesting case involving not SCU but Caltech, most modern university in the world, I suppose, where a Caltech student from China was accused by his ex-girlfriend and her new boyfriend, also from China, of various offenses, supposedly proved by email sent from his machine. He ended up spending 6 months in prison before he was tried. The evidence presented at trial was strikingly inconsistent with the claims of his accusers. In particular, it was reasonably clear that his ex-girlfriend had the password to his computer and therefore could easily enough have she or her brother, who was in town, who was a computer tech person, could have forged the supposedly abusive emails that supposedly were sent by him. It was clear. Well, there were various bits and pieces of their story, none of which were supported by evidence, and some of which were contradicted by evidence. The jury took half an hour to dismiss all charges. Caltech then had its own hearing and expelled him. And as far as I can tell, Caltech was in the wrong. Indeed, was probably violating its own rules. Now, I have a somewhat biased view of the subject. The first person I talked to about it was a Caltech lawyer. When I discovered that she had given me a radically inaccurate account of what happened, when I followed up with other sources, I concluded, well, yes, it's her business to defend her clients, but I don't trust people who lie to me. But anyway, that is an interesting case. I talk about people that are interested. I should say the guy who got expelled was apparently the student who came in first in China in a national exam. So he was not a random person. He was a very bright person. And part of what interested me was the whole issue of how you do evidence and such in a world of online transactions. And here you had a population where everybody was 20 years ahead of the rest of us. Right? As I put it, if they ever have a course in Caltech on computer intrusion, they will have no shortage of experienced students to take it. Anyway, but that was another example of an embedded legal system. So, how do embedded legal systems work? One answer, and the answer most that we've mostly looked at, is they use punishments that are not in violation of the higher legal system. So that there is nothing in American law that says that your friends have to talk to you, or that your relatives have to talk to you. Therefore, if the Amish decree nobody in this community is going to have anything to do with you beyond very minimal contacts, they aren't breaking the law, they aren't compelling anybody to do anything, therefore they can enforce it in that fashion. Similarly for the similar things done by gypsies. Similarly, if a university expels you, there may be some limits, some contractual restrictions, but to a large extent, the university is free to do what it pleases. I should mention another case, which was sort of interesting, which I've also discussed, also a lower tech email case at Cornell many years ago, where some students circulated among their friends a list of misogynist jokes, anti-woman, women jokes. And the list somehow got out to somebody outside their circle, who then broadcast it very widely, and there was a huge outcry against them. And the question was, were they violating Cornell's rules in using its email system? And the final result of this was that Cornell announced they were not violating the rules, they were not being punished, but they had voluntarily agreed to the following set of essentially voluntary punishments. Now, How voluntary a freshman agreeing to do something that his university wants him to do, I will leave to your own imagination. And the fun part of that was that an email then went out to a huge number of people associated to Cornell, which purported to be from the administrator responsible for dealing with this case, and which was talking about how we managed to both maintain our reputation for freedom of speech and properly punish the three little pigs by what we have done. It was a fake. It was a fake which asked people to respond. And the people who sent it out, the response, of course, didn't go to the real email the person was supposed to be from. They went to the email who sent out the fake email. And they then sent out a second one quoting those people who said, yeah, good thing too. And, of course, they were... It was also bogus in the sense that they sent it out to 5,000 people. Of course, some of them are going to say punishing them while pretending not to is the right thing to do. That doesn't really tell you that was really what was happening, but that was obviously the effect the people doing. And it was an ingenious bit of the use of modern technology for propaganda. And I don't know whether, you know, to what extent those students were really quietly told you had better agree to do this and this, or you're going to have a very hard 4 years at Cornell. But that was another interesting case where in that case, you could fit that into my, you know, God is the legislature case, in the sense that given the theoretical commitment to freedom of speech, they couldn't officially punish them, but they could still unofficially punish them if they wanted to. Anyway, so... Let me go on. So one way of doing it is to use non-illegal sanctions. But the use of that really depends on the community having something they can deprive the members of. So that it works much better if the members really want to be members of that community. So if you think about the gypsy situation, if you've been brought up, first, if you're in a society where all non-gypsies know that all gypsies are thieves and slime and generally untrustworthy people, and all gypsies know that all non-gypsies are filthy, polluted, ignorant people who don't understand the right way of doing anything, then the cost of having no gypsy willing to associate with you is really high, and that means you have a really powerful sanction available to use for the community. Amish is a less extreme case. The Amish aren't particularly unpopular with the rest of the world, but nonetheless, pretty clearly, if you've been brought up as Amish, not having your friends and relatives willing to talk to you is a fairly serious cost. This is also part of the reason why both the Amish and the Gypsies want to stay out of the school system, because the public school system is going to acculturate their kids to the surrounding culture and thus make them less strongly identify with their parents' culture and thus, among other things, reduce the effectiveness of the threat of ostracism as a way of enforcing rules. And there's a problem in these systems of a tension between keeping your people in. But if you do too good a job of keeping your people in, you're keeping in the unhappy ones, and that creates internal conflict within your society. And there's some evidence of this in the Amish case, because there are two versions of Maidu, two versions of ostracism, referred to as the strong ostracism, and I guess probably schwach is probably the word, whatever the word is, weak ostracism. And weak ostracism means that having been ostracized, if you are then accepted into any Amish congregation, it doesn't have to be the original one, or into a Mennonite congregation, because the Mennonites are sort of, you know, half Amish, as it were, after a while your own congregation will drop the Maidun on you, and your friends, family, and relatives are free to associate with you again. Strang Maidun, the view is it's only when you've made your peace with your own congregation that you get unostracized. All right. The most of the German-based Amish congregations, which are the earlier immigrants, use the weak version. Most of the Swiss-based, which were the later, use the strong version, as do the Schwarzentruber Amish, who are the strictest of the German-based groups, the lowest in their terminology, because low is good. Right? Humility is a good thing. And there is at least some pattern that on the one hand, the Strang Maidun groups lose a smaller fraction of their population each generation, that they keep something over 90%. But on the other hand, they're also more prone to internal conflicts, to fracturing the group into two groups, and that the Schwarzentruber, whereas the ordinary Amish, when they leave, are likely to become Mennonites. When Schwarzentruber leave, they leave very far away from that whole set of institutions. Yes?
So the Amish are using ignorance as a form of social control.
I'm not sure ignorance is quite a fair sense, because after all, you're allowed to talk to people, you can observe the surrounding society.
Education is so limited.
I don't think it's the limit of the education as the limit of the acculturation that's a result of the education that is relevant. That is, as far as I can tell, it's true they don't, in fact, run through high school. But it's also true that somebody with an eighth-grade education who's been running a farm is probably a pretty good employee for quite a lot of different jobs. And the Amish do, in fact, in Indiana, the Amish do work factory work, so they've got the option of doing that sort of thing. So I think it's less a matter of being ignorant in the sense of not knowing things than of identifying with a particular culture rather than other cultures.
But they just know simple, practical things.
What do you think ordinary high school graduates know? Do you think they can actually, you know, prove the Pythagorean theorem, say? I mean, our ordinary K-12 system does not consistently produce well-educated scholarly people.
But these people are not allowed to go to college.
Yeah, that's right. Lots of people don't go to college. Probably, yeah.
May I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
Professor,
yeah.
Could you go out and start a farm?
Nope. I can grow fruit trees, I do. No. Starting a farm, no, I couldn't. There are lots of different skills out there, and they are skilled in a set of useful skills. But we do observe that ones leaving farming business have been fairly successful in starting small businesses. That's a useful activity out in the world. But my younger son is completing his first year at University of Chicago at this point. Yeah, I think it's his first year still. And is rather unhappy. Or maybe it's his second year. Anyway, I should keep better track of my kids. But he's rather unhappy there. He writes. I discovered a year or so ago, yeah, I guess it's got to be his second year, right? I discovered a year or so ago that he'd written a pretty good novelette, which I read, and he invents board games. That's his hobby. And I proposed to him very recently, because he was unhappy at school, that if he wanted, he could come home, he's going to be home this summer. If he can produce either a board game or a novel that the family regards as of commercially publishable quality, we will not object to his taking the next year off from school. And if he succeeds in getting it published during that year, he can quit school if he likes. That is, our view is that the standard assumption that everybody should go through this sequence of 16 years is crazy, that there are some people for whom it's a very sensible kind of education, others for whom it's not, and if it really turns out that he can make a career doing what he wants to do without spending the time doing there, that's just fine. And, you know, I'm biased because I teach at the undergraduate and graduate level in two fields, and neither of which I've ever taken a course for credit in my life. Yeah, in that respect.
I'd like to ask a question.
Sure.
A person is booted out of this group of Amish, and he goes into another one, and he proves himself good, and then the other group, can he always go back to the original group?
The normal rule seems to be that you can always go back to your original group if you're willing to apologize and stop misbehaving. That seems to be the normal rule. Now, you know, obviously, since this is a decentralized system, you can't guarantee they're all identical, but that seems to be the standard pattern. But also, of course, the Amish are willing to associate with non-Amish, so it's not like you can't associate with a non-Amish. What you can't associate with is an Amish who has violated and kept violating the rules enough so that he's been subject to Maidun, if you're an Amish. So, in any case, so that's one set of ways of enforcing it. Another way of enforcing it is illegal sanctions. And I think it's pretty clearly clear that gypsies have occasionally done things to other gypsies that are not legal. And pretty clearly the Roman chawl, the feud system, it's not in fact legal to beat somebody up or kill him just because he cheated you. And it's not legal in the college blood feud are clearly doing things that are illegal under Finnish law. And part of what makes that workable is main, what I think of as staying below the radar. Having a community that's sort of tight enough so that the rest of the world doesn't know enough about you to monitor you and control you. So that I mentioned earlier that the estimates of total gypsy population run from 3 to 15 million. That's a big range. It's not accidental that it's a big range. Because the gypsies, in general, avoid being counted. They avoid being kept track of. Gypsies, at least Blatron gypsies, treat names as a fungible commodity. All right? Your family has got somebody in it called Charlie. Which of you is Charlie? Well, that depends on who it's useful to be Charlie today. It is apparently not uncommon if somebody important in a gypsy family, these are extended families for the Blatron, not for the Romanschau, if he's done something illegal and in effect gets caught, somebody else will take the blame, will go to prison on his behalf, and will be treated very well by his own people for having, you know, thrown himself on the grenade, so to speak. So that you've got a system where pretty clearly part of what it's designed to do is not to be too visible, and where in the past that's worked tolerably well. Now, one of the problems these systems run into, in particular, I think, decentralized systems, is their interaction with the overgovernment. So in the case of the Amish, they had to have some way of bargaining with the government over the draft arrangements. They wanted to have some way of litigating their Supreme Court case about schools. And so they formed a committee, a national Amish committee, which had no legal authority over the Amish, but which gets treated by the U.S. government as sort of the spokesman for the Amish. And I think it was mostly Amish and some non-Amish sympathizers, as far as I can tell. At the state level, they set up similar committees for bargaining over the details of the school regulations, which were state by state rather than federal. Potentially, this is dangerous from the standpoint of their system. You can imagine a story, and it hasn't happened, but you can imagine a story where the Amish steering committee for dealing with these things at the national level says, look, here are some recommended rules on how to run your one-room and two-room schoolhouses so as not to offend the government regulatory authorities and thus not to get other Amish into trouble. And by the way, if you don't obey these rules and keep not obeying them, when your kids ask for conscientious objector status, we won't know them. That hasn't happened. But you can see how there's a potential leverage for creating a central authority, leveraging the fact that that the non-Amish central government treats this organization as representing the Amish. And I guess, so far, at least their ideology has been strong enough so that it's prevented that kind of thing from happening. But if you sort of try to think of it as where are the weak points in some system of social organization, you can see some danger for a drift away from their system due to the need to interact in that fashion. There are other conflicts that have occurred. One of the ones that occurs on the state level is over marking buggies, because buggies are a traffic hazard at night, and according to which Amish congregation it is, it isn't clear what kinds of markings of buggies do or don't violate their rules. So that, you know, red lights on the back, well, that sort of looks like showing off and display and stuff like that. And I gather that most of the Amish congregations have reached compromises with the local authorities such that their buggies are not an unreasonable hazard and are not doing things they disapprove of, but that's been another area of occasional friction over what the rules are. Now, one point that struck me, in fact, I had a blog post on it a year or so ago, reading about this stuff, is that all of us moderns claim to be in favor of both toleration and diversity. And to some extent, they're in conflict with each other. If I go back to the Jewish case, it's pretty clear, reading the 4-volume book on Jewish law that was my main source, that though he doesn't quite say so, he sees the shift in the 18th century towards treating French Jews not as Jews who lived in France but as Frenchmen who happened to be Jewish as a disaster from the standpoint of Jewish law. All right? And I'm not taking France as one example. But that in general, prior to that, from a standpoint of Jewish law, they were a real legal system. They had authority over their own people. Once you start being really tolerant and saying, no, no, they're just Frenchmen like everybody else, they happen to have a different religion, now you undercut this whole independent system and you make the world less diverse. There's a very interesting, I don't know, have any of you ever read G.K. Chesterton, English author? Very good, interesting, weird English author. He's now remembered mainly as a Catholic apologist, but he also wrote some very good early detective stories in which the detective is Father Brown, English priest, and wrote lots of other stuff. Essays, he was sort of a political thinker, I think a brilliant writer just in terms of the style of his essays and stuff, but also a pretty good poet. But he has an essay which is really about Zionism somewhere. And according to which part of the quote you wrote, the essay you quote, you can make him look like either a Zionist or an anti-Semite. Because the basic thesis is Jews in England aren't really Englishmen. There's nothing wrong with them. You know, Frenchmen aren't really Englishmen either. But you can't pretend they are Englishmen. But on the other hand, he says, what do people have against the Jews? It's that they do things like money lending instead of farming and ordering. Well, given that we won't let them farm, that's not too surprising. And when they come to us and say, give us some land of our own and we'll be farmers, it's pretty harsh to refuse. So in a sense, he's simultaneously, he has somewhere, he has, his proposal is that all restrictions on Jews should be eliminated with one exception. They should have to wear special dress in order that they will identify as aliens among us. Well, that sounds anti-Semitic from one standpoint, but I bet there are a lot of, and I can remember, in fact, I was traveling in Europe many years ago, and I was sitting in, I think, a youth hostel with a bunch of, I was a graduate student at the time, a bunch of other young men of similar age. And somehow in the conversation, I asked them where they were from. And they gave some very implausible answers. I forget what they were. And then one of them said, can I see your passport? And I showed him my passport. And he said, oh, I'm from France the same way you're from America, and he's from Germany, and he's from Italy. They were all Jews. And it wasn't the way I thought, because I'm from a very tolerant society. But that was the way they saw it. And that was, I thought, very interesting. That sort of mirrors Chesterton's point. Same thing with regard to the gypsies. What will destroy the gypsies in North America, maybe, is toleration. Is the fact that to the extent that we don't see them as filthy pigs, it becomes easier and easier if they don't like the way their system is running to defect. And there's been some, one of the things that apparently has happened is Vlachram in America coming to an agreement to ease their divorce rules in the direction a little closer to our divorce rules, so there will be less pressure for, I guess, either men or women who aren't happy with their marriages to drop out of the Vlachram community in order to be able to get divorced. So you can see that there's an interesting sense in which toleration and diversity are in conflict, because intoleration is one of the things that keeps separate different communities within society. Anyway, I thought that was sort of an interesting point that is not immediately obvious, but I find it at least quite intriguing in all of this. Now, we've been going... No, we haven't been going for an hour and a quarter, not time yet. All right. I wanted to say a little bit more about something that's not quite the same as embedded legal systems as related to it, and that's polylegal systems. System in which you have multiple legal systems coexisting on the same territory. And that's, again, a good deal more common than people usually think. What first got my attention to it was a talk a long time ago, I think at the University of Chicago, by a historian, I suppose, who was describing how in the Middle Ages, in Spain during the Reconquista, the period when Muslim Spain was getting conquered from the north by the Christian kingdoms, the usual pattern was that when a Muslim area essentially surrendered, part of the deal was that they were still under Muslim law. They were being ruled by a Christian, but they were Muslims under Muslim law, just like the Jews under Jewish law. And eventually that broke down. After 100 years or so, they started forcing them to convert and become Christians. But there was an extended period of time when many Muslims in a Spanish kingdom were under Muslim law, while Christians were under Christian law. In the south coast of the Baltic, where you had interactions between German and Slavic populations, you had German merchants coming in. This is prior to any serious conquest, I think. And it was not uncommon that the Slavic princes would guarantee the German merchants that their disputes could be judged under their law rather than under the legal rule. In Britain, Welshmen in Wales were not under English law until something like the 15th or 16th century. Prior to that, Welshmen in Wales were under Welsh law. Englishmen in Wales were under English law. So those are all systems of that sort. And I suppose the one perhaps best recorded, which I may have mentioned before, is the millet system of the Ottoman Empire, in which each of many different ethnic minorities had its own legal system and its own rulers, subject to the overrule of the Sultan. So that essentially the top member of some particular Christian sect probably had a pension from the Sultan, maybe even lived in Istanbul, but aside from the fact that he would behave himself, he and his people were in a sense legally independent. They still obviously had to pay taxes, they had to do various things the government wanted them to do, but for many purposes they were independent. Now, polylegal systems don't really raise any problem as long as all disputes are within each community. As long as it's Muslims having a dispute with Muslims, Christians with Christians, Jews with Jews, Germans with Germans, Slavs with Slavs, Welshmen with Welshmen, now you know what the law is. The only problem that arises is the cross cases. What happens when a Welshman and an Englishman have a dispute? And I don't really have a general answer to how that's done. There are a number of obvious possibilities. One of them is there is some superior system that handles the cross cases. So, for example, it might be that if you have a Muslim ruler, then Muslim-Christian cases go to the Muslim court, which in fact was the case in Muslim cities. And for all I know, the Christian rulers in Spain, it went the other way. Another system that you could have is internal rules where the nature of the case determines. So I don't know of any examples, but you could certainly imagine, well, I guess I do know an example, but I'll go to that in a minute. You could imagine a case where the defendant's court always ruled. So if I sue you, I got to sue you in your court. If you sue me, you have to sue me in my court. That would have the virtue or vice, as you like to see it, of reducing the amount of litigation. Because I would be less willing to sue you if I knew the court was likely to sympathize with you. It occurred to me that, in fact, we have the opposite system in our system to some degree. You have what's referred to as forum shopping, which is that if I want to sue you, one of the things I might choose to do is to say, I could plausibly argue that I'm suing you in either Texas or California. Suppose we both do business. Which court is more likely to agree with me? That's what's called forum shopping in the legal context. So I guess we have some element of that in our system as well. And indeed in our federal system. As you may know, although in some theoretical sense there's a single federal law, any lawyer will tell you there is a law of the circuit. That is, there are different federal circuits. We're in the Ninth Circuit. I like to say that the University of Chicago is the only law school in the country with its own circuit, because a noticeable number of the judges on the Seventh Circuit have been at least University of Chicago professors. And the different circuits, to some degree, have different law. Not different legislation, but different precedents. So that if you are a lower court judge in this circuit, you're expected to follow the precedent of the appeals court of the Ninth Circuit. Eventually, if the Ninth Circuit has one precedent and the Seventh Circuit an inconsistent one, you may end up, that may be grounds for getting the Supreme Court to look at the case, and then both of them are supposed to obey the Supreme Court. But not all cases reach the Supreme Court, so that in fact the law of circuits is to some degree different, which again gives you an option for forum shopping, which is a potential problem. All right, yes?
Say the Senate has a legal system of their own because they're refusing to approve any of the
But that's still a part of the. It's a part of the legal of the federal legal system because the Obama doesn't get to appoint judges, right? If Obama gets to propose, I don't know what the technical term is, but propose judges to be approved by the Senate. So I think that's. It might be that if I knew enough about the Senate, there's some interesting sense in which it has its own legal system. But I think the fact that the Senate gets to approve or not approve federal judges really is part of the single federal legal system, right? It's not like judges work for the president.
Mm-hmm.
this has been, I mean, as you may know, there have been sizable fights over this for quite a long time from both sides. That is, that when there's a Republican president and enough Democrats in the Senate, the Republican president has a hard time getting his judges approved, and when there's a Democratic president, enough Republicans. I don't know. It's a different context, but somewhere or other I saw a discussion of the things people were saying about each other in the U.S. and the politicians in the late 18th century, and it makes our discussion look pretty mild. It seems likely that the famous duel between Burr and Hamilton was over one of them accusing the other of having an affair with his own daughter. That would be one example. So I think I've covered what I wanted to cover under that category, and I was going to go on to a couple more legal systems, three more legal systems I find interesting. Let me just stop for a minute to see if people have questions about what I've been saying about embedded legal systems. No? All right. If you want to stop me, you have to speak fast. All right. I wanted to talk then about, if I have time, three different legal systems that I find interesting. Those being Periclean Athens, 18th century England, and traditional Somalia. And we'll see if we can get through all of them and then say a few more things at the end. Periclean Athens, we refer to it as a democracy, but only in the sense in which the Amish were a democracy, in as much as all of the officials except the generals in Periclean Athens were chosen by lot, not by election. They had votes for the laws in the assembly, which consisted of any adult male citizen who made it to the assembly, but the officials were chosen by a lottery of all male citizens of appropriate age. I don't remember what the exact age limits were, for one-year terms. So it really was an amateur government. If you think about arguments over term limits, say, sort of part of the theory of supporters of term limits is that we don't want our legislators to become professional legislators. We want them to be citizen legislators. The Athenians did it. Worked well or badly, you can argue, but they did indeed do it. The exception were generals. I think they tried choosing generals by lot, and it didn't work very well. But the rest they did. The jurors were paid volunteers. They were getting a payment which I think was something like maybe half what a ordinary laborer would get, so not trivial but not very good. And it looks as though the jury system may in part have been a welfare system, have been a way in which poor people could feed themselves by volunteering for the jury. They had big juries. We aren't sure of the details, but it looks as though there were about 500 jurors to a case. I did a calculation at some point, and I think it looks as though maybe 5 or 10% of the population at any given time were being jurors. The categories of people, there were three main categories: citizens, medics, and slaves. Medics were resident aliens. They were not slaves, but they had a very restricted set of rights. They couldn't vote in the assembly. They could participate in the legal system in various ways. They couldn't own land in Athens, and so forth. Slaves were slaves. Our sources for Athenian law are not very good. A lot of it is surviving orations. That the way a law case went in Athens was you did not have a lawyer. Each party was required to represent himself. But you were allowed to hire an orator to write you an oration that you then memorized and delivered. Some of these orations were good enough literature to have survived. So the result is there are a whole lot of cases for which what we have is one side speech. And we typically don't know what the verdict was. We don't know if that one side was lying or not. We don't have the rebuttals by the other side. But nonetheless, you can piece together a good deal about a legal system. There's some other evidence. There are references in the plays. There are boundary markers, stones with inscriptions on them. There are engravings of bits and pieces of laws. But we have nothing like a complete account. Nothing like, say, Jewish law or Islamic law, where we have very extensive information. I'm just going to run through a bunch of features that I thought were sort of neat about that system.
What was the historical time that you're...
I'm talking about Pericles in Athens, which is 4th, 5th century B.C. Probably Pericles didn't live for 200 years, but he lived for part of that. He's sort of identified with the period. The criminal system was almost entirely privately prosecuted, so that there were magistrates, but what the normal system was that I accuse you of something and I go to the appropriate magistrate and then I prosecute the case. And according to what I'm accusing you of, there are a variety of different formalities of which magistrate I go to and what I get to do first and so forth. But in almost all the cases, there are some exceptions, but almost all cases, it was a private volunteer prosecutor who was the prosecutor, not the equivalent of a DA in our system. Why do you prosecute? One reason is that most of the crimes were punished by fines, and the prosecutor got something like a third of the fine, again, depending on the particular nature of the case, but he usually got a sizable fraction of the fine as his reward. There could be other reasons. You could be a political enemy of mine, for example. There is one case involving, I think, Demosthenes, where, if I remember correctly, Demosthenes was voted a crown for service to the city of Athens, and one of his enemies prosecuted either him or somebody else on the grounds that he hadn't served Athens and therefore didn't deserve the crown. And this is by memory, so I probably got the details wrong. But you clearly get cases where it's involved with personal quarrels and political disputes and so forth. But a lot of it seems to have been just a matter if you prosecute in the hope of getting money. And there's an obvious problem with that system. Same problem that we see in the equivalent things in our tort system. Namely, that you will go after somebody who is unpopular and rich, figuring that if you can persuade this large jury by lots of passionate rhetoric, you can get lots of money out of it. The Athenians were aware of this problem. The Athenians had two solutions to this problem. The first one was that if you were not able to get at least 20% of this large jury to vote for conviction, the prosecutor was fined. 1,000 drachma, 3 years' wages for an ordinary worker. So if you were rich, it was a fairly small fine, but for an ordinary person, a non-trivial fine. Furthermore, there was a procedure at the end of each year when there were a bunch of procedures for accusing officials of having done things wrong, and you could also accuse somebody of, I remember there's a term in Greek which means something else, of sycophants. A sycophant in Greek, in Athenian law, was someone who engaged in false prosecution, basically. And you could charge people with that and try them for that and convict them of that. So they were aware of the problem, but nonetheless they did it that way. Furthermore, for at least some tort cases, they had a similar rule, although we know less about the details of that. But it is clear that there were at least some, by a tort case, I mean a case where I'm claiming not that you deserve criminal penalty, which would be applying to the state, but that you owe me money because you've injured me in some way. And the rule in some cases, and we aren't sure how many, maybe all, was that if I sued you and lost, I owed you 1/6 of the amount that I had claimed you owed me. And we aren't sure if that was only if I couldn't get a fifth of the jurors to vote or if it was I couldn't get a majority. We just don't know that. So the details we don't know. But I'm working on an article suggesting introducing a version of that into our legal system on the grounds that under our system, since we know that courts make mistakes, even if I know you're innocent, it may pay me to sue you. Figuring, well, if I lose, I don't lose anything except my lawyer's fee, and if I win, you'll pay me money. And so I'm suggesting that maybe you ought to have a rule in which when I sue you and lose, I owe some damages to you. So anyway, that's one interesting idea that sort of comes out of their system. Bunch of other things. One of the interesting things in a murder case was that after the first murder case, you could be sentenced to execution or to exile if you were convicted. After the first day of the trial, the defendant had the option of self-exile. So if you think you're going to lose and get executed, right, which was interesting. Another interesting feature of their legal system was that after the jury convicts you, in many cases, there's still a question of what the penalty is. Well, it's sort of hard with this big jury for the jury to set a penalty, and there isn't really an equivalent of the judge. So what you do instead is that the prosecutor proposes a penalty, the defense proposes a penalty, and the jury votes between them. So you can see there's an interesting kind of logic to that, because as the defense, you'd like the penalty to be as light as possible, but if it's too light, they'll choose the one the prosecutor wants. The prosecutor wants as heavy as possible, but if it's too heavy, they'll choose the defense. So there's going to be some tendency to push them, together. When Socrates was convicted of impiety, I think his original proposal was that his penalty ought to be that he receive a pension. And his friends talked him into agreeing to pay a fine, which they would pay for him. But in fact, the jury voted for the prosecution's proposed penalty, which was execution. So, a few other examples of what I think is sort of neat about Athenian law. One of them I'm not sure if I mentioned to you before. It's a story I like to tell, though, and that has to do with stolen property. That under Athenian law, if I can prove you stole my property, I not only get the property back, you also owe me its value in addition. And the obvious way of proving you've stolen my property is to search your house and find it. And the obvious risk, familiar to anybody who knows what things drug police sometimes do, is that I'll smuggle in the property and then claim to find it. The Athenians have a very simple solution to this problem. I am entitled to search your property, but I've got to do it stark naked. This is not a society with nudity taboos, as you may realize. Another one that I like to describe the Athenian system as the legal system of a mad economist, because it's got all sorts of clever logical ideas that might or might not work. And one of them goes as follows. You have the problem of producing a public good, something which basically, if it's produced, it's supposed to benefit everybody in Athens. And their solution is that if you are one of the richest Athenians, every other year you have to produce a public good. So the relevant magistrate comes to you and says, you know, you've heard we're planning to send a team to the Olympics this year. Congratulations, you're the sponsor. Or do you see that lovely trireme down on the deck, a warship? Guess who's paying her bills this year? And there are two ways of getting out of it. One way is to show that either this year or last year, you already were doing such a thing. You only have to do it once every other year. The other way is to show that there is another Athenian who is richer than you are and isn't doing one this year and didn't do one last year. How in a world without accountants and IRS do I prove you're richer than I am? The way I prove you're richer than I am is that I offer to exchange everything I own for everything you own. And if you turn me down, you've just admitted you're richer than I am. Isn't that elegant? So those would be a number of interesting examples. Another interesting feature of the system, which reminds me of some of the other things we've read about, is the idea of miasma. Miasma is what the gypsies would call marame. It's pollution. And in particular, murder results in miasma. And miasma is contagious. So if you're accused of murder, you have to stay out of the temples and out of the courts, I assume with the exception of the court you're tried in, until the case is settled. Because otherwise, all the other Athenians who have to be in those places might catch it from you, so to speak. And there are a couple of interesting law cases which show how this kind of idea could be abused or manipulated. And one of them is a case where somebody claims that the reason he's been accused of murder, this is somebody who was in charge of a boys' chorus, and one of the choristers was given a drug that was supposed to improve his voice but actually died from it. And the question was whether the man who was in charge of the chorus, who I don't think was the one who actually gave him the drug, was considered guilty of murder. And his story was, after the boy died, his family didn't accuse me, they didn't get anything wrong, but then I was involved in a law case with somebody. And the people in that case got them to accuse me in order that I couldn't go to court and prosecute the law case, because I now have the answer. The other case is that there was a long war with Sparta, as you may know, which Sparta won. And when the Spartans came in, they set up an Athenian, not exactly dictatorship, because it was, I think, 30 families, as I remember, but basically a temporary dictatorial government over Athens, which was then overthrown fairly shortly. And part of the settlement terms was amnesty for everything that happened during that period. and there was somebody who wanted to accuse one of the 30 of having killed some relative of his during the period when the 30 were running things. And the amnesty said he couldn't charge him with having killed him. So he charged him with having committed murder, which he couldn't be punished for because of the amnesty, and then gone to temples. After the amnesty was over, even though he obviously had the asthma because he had committed murder. So it was a way of evading the amnesty rule. Which again strikes me as sort of interesting. And another interesting bit of that is one of the cases where somebody is accused of murdering someone. And this is a case of a sea voyage. And someone who goes with them vanishes at one point during the voyage. And it's not clear there's any good evidence that this guy actually killed him, but somebody's accusing him of it. And he says, well, look, he vanished on the outward leg of the voyage. If I really killed him, I would have been suffering from asthma. And I would have had bad luck. But we made the voyage all the way there and back, and the ship wasn't wrecked. We didn't have any terrible storms. So I couldn't have been under asthma, so I couldn't have been guilty. Whether that convicts people, we don't know, but I thought it was quite a neat argument. All right, I think we've done an hour and a quarter at this point, so why don't we take our break now, and I will continue with more stuff afterwards. Thank you all for coming. I much prefer a course where I don't have to give any grades and where everybody in the room is there because he wants to be there and not to satisfy a requirement somewhere. That sort of is what I think of as fitting into the unschooling point of view on education. There's a wonderful discussion of schooling by Adam Smith, by the way, and he has a comment that in the case of children or young boys, it may perhaps be necessary to compel attendance at the classes where they learn the rudiments of education. But beyond the age of 12 or 13, compulsion need play no role in schooling. No compulsion is needed to compel attendance at those lectures that are worth attending, as is known where such lectures are given. And that's a slap at Oxford, I think, or Oxford and Cambridge, which he doesn't think very highly of. But it's a very Smith on education is quite a lot of fun. Anyway, all right, let me go on to talk a bit more about the Athenian law. And one of the interesting features of it was the role of the household. Every household had what was called a kyrios, which is roughly lord. It's the same word that becomes God in Greek bits in Christian singing and stuff, Kyrie. And basically, the Kyrios is really the sort of senior male member of the household. In addition, a particular person, such as a particular woman, had to have a Kyrios. Women are very definitely not equal citizens in Athens, although they are citizens. And the woman's kyrios would be her father until she was married, her husband after she was married. And if her husband died, she could either go back to her father's household, or she could remain in the household, which was probably now headed by her son, as the senior male remaining, at which point he was her kyrios. But he was, the kyrios was in effect the legal representative. In order for a woman to be married, it was her kyrios' consent, not her consent, that was required. In order to be divorced, ditto. A dying husband could will his wife and her dowry to somebody else. Seduction was a more serious crime than rape. And if you think about the system, there's a logic to that. Because rape does not imply that the wife has herself been unfaithful. Seduction does. All right. So if you think about it as a crime not against the woman, but against her husband, you can see that just as it would be a more serious crime if someone persuades the treasurer of your company to siphon money to him than if somebody breaks into the strong room and steals money, because now you can't trust people. So in the same way. But it was very interesting, sort of the different perspective that came out of that system. And one of the most extreme bits of that I found intriguing is the situation of an heiress. An heiress is a woman whose father has no sons, and therefore she inherits the property. And when the father dies, she must marry the closest male relative outside the limits of the incest rules who is willing to marry her. whether or not she is already married to someone else.
What?
So if she's married to someone else and her male cousin wants to marry her, she has to divorce her husband and marry him.
Keep the money in the family.
It's keeping the household property together, essentially. So you will have to ask. You will have to find yourself a Pericles Athenian to ask that question to. I am only reporting on what seemed to me an odd and interesting part of a system, which is, I think, probably an inherent, internally coherent system, but one with based on very different systems than ours. One final bit, which is interesting because it then ties into a different legal system, is that the testimony of slaves could only be taken under torture. And you could only torture a slave with his owner's permission, because you might injure his property after all. On the other hand, you could introduce at trial the fact that the owner refused to let his slave be tortured, which you might take as evidence that the slave knew the owner was guilty and therefore the owner didn't want to let him testify. But there are two interesting bits that I came across. Apparently the same rule existed in Roman law. And the only explanation I've seen is the idea that because the owner had lots of ways of putting pressure on the slave couldn't be trusted to tell the truth unless there was something forcing him to do so. And the obvious argument against testimony under torture is that a person will say whatever you want him to say in order to stop the torture. And my guess, and it's only a guess, is that they believe that a competent interrogator could tell whether the slave was really telling the truth now, or whether he was just speaking under torture. But what I thought was interesting is that we have two surviving orations discussing the reliability of evidence given by slaves under torture. And one of the orations makes the obvious argument that the evidence is worthless because they'll say whatever they have to say. The other oration says there has never been a case in the history of Athens where the testimony of a slave given under torture turned out to be false. It's a perfectly reliable method. Both orations were written by the same orator. But the other thing that's interesting is that one of my students did a paper on Visigothic law. The Visigoths were the Germanic tribe that ended up ruling Spain before the Muslims conquered it. And it turns out there is a surviving Visigothic law code, which is the earliest of the Germanic law codes to have survived. And I could attach this to me so you can hear me. And the surviving Visigothic law code discusses the question of testimony under torture. And they've got an answer. Their system goes as follows. I accuse you of a crime, and the judge decides there's not enough evidence to either convict or acquit, so they have to torture you. Before they can torture you, I have to give a detailed description of the crime. If your testimony under torture doesn't meet that description, it's not accepted. And I think I'm punished, if I remember correctly. If I have made public the details of the crime, they're not allowed to torture you. So what they're doing, I mean, it makes logical sense. They're saying, we need a way of checking. And the way we can check is if he didn't do it, he won't know the details. And it's the same method that we use. Probably has some of the same weaknesses, but that one of the methods that we use is somebody confesses, and supposedly the evidence of the confession is true, is that he says things he wouldn't have otherwise known. And the obvious risk is that the cop coaches him in order to feed him the information and then denies doing it so that the confession will be accepted. But you can see that the basic approach of trying to find some way of testing the reliability of what might be false testimony, and I thought that was really neat, that it was sort of, they were thinking about the problem, just as the Athenians were, and they were coming up with a not unreasonable solution in their context. All right, let me go on to talk about another legal system, 18th century English criminal law, which along with Iceland was one of the two that originally got me interested in exotic legal systems. And I originally got into it because the reputation of that system is that everything was a capital crime, the so-called bloody code, where if you stole more than 40 shillings, you were hanged. And it turns out that's a considerable oversimplification. But also that's not the most interesting thing about the legal system. One of the most interesting things about the legal system is that, like the Athenian system, it was privately prosecuted. So if somebody stole your horse, it was up to you to find out who did it. You then had to go to the constable to arrest him, but it was then up to you, not the constable, to get the evidence to convict him. Unlike the Athenian system, he didn't pay a fine and you didn't collect a share of the fine he didn't pay. And the question then that arises is, why does anybody bother to prosecute crimes? And yet they did. And there are basically three answers. The first is, I want my horse back. But of course, if that's all it is, once it's clear that I can show he did it, the thief would be happy to give me my horse back and just have me drop the matter. So that doesn't explain prosecuting it any further than that. The second reason to prosecute it is in order to be paid not to. All right, so suppose I've got the evidence on you, and if convicted, you may get hanged, but I will be willing to forget about it if you do something for me. This was illegal, but there is good evidence that it was actually happening. There is a set of documents from an 18th century judge, the so-called Ryder documents, and there are one or two cases he describes where it is quite clear that the victim is trying to get somebody to pay him to drop charges. But there's a third reason, and the third is the one that I find most interesting, and that's deterrence. And after all, why do we bother to prosecute crimes in our system? It's not like you're going to get anything out of the criminal, and the reason is so there will be fewer crimes. At least that's what we would like to believe the reason is. And the obvious problem with doing that with private prosecution is that deterring crime in general doesn't do me much good. There are lots of potential victims. So the trick is to make deterrence into a private good rather than a public good. And there are two approaches to doing this. One of them is, if you are a very likely and highly visible victim. So suppose I'm in the business of dyeing cloth, and I've got valuable cloth spread out in the sun to dry all the time, and somebody could sneak up at night and take some of the cloth and run off. So it's in my interest, if I catch the person who did it, to see him hanged, so other people won't do it to me. Most potential victims are not in that situation. So the solution they came up with was an institution called an Association for the Prosecution of Felons. And this would normally be in one town, and it would consist of probably most of the better off members of the town, each of whom paid an annual fee, which provided a pool of money that would pay the cost of prosecuting a felony committed against any member. So far, it sounds like insurance. But it isn't insurance. The final step is that the list of members is published in the newspaper for the felons to read. So what it really is pre-commitment. It's really like Odysseus tying himself to the mast to make sure he couldn't jump in and drown himself when he heard the sirens singing. So it's a way of making sure that after you're stolen, it's not in your interest to prosecute because it costs time and effort. Before you're stolen from, it's your interest to have people know you will prosecute, because then they probably won't steal from you. So the Association for the Prosecution of Felons, of which there were thousands of them, is an ingenious way of pre-committing to prosecution as a way of turning deterrence into a private good rather than a public good. So that was what I found, in a sense, most interesting about that half of the problem. The other half of the problem has to do with the whole punishment system. And let me give you a little bit of somewhat relevant and interesting history, which has to do with what was called benefit of clergy. Go back to early Norman England. You have two legal systems. More than two, but at least two. You've got royal law and you've got church law. And clergymen were, in a sense, citizens of the church, in a sense in which they weren't citizens of the kingdom. And the result was that a clergyman who was accused of a crime could plead his clergy and have his case transferred to the church courts. The church courts did not have capital punishment. So that meant that if you were a clergyman accused of murder, you got the case transferred to a church court where you might be sentenced to be on bread and water for a year or something, but you wouldn't hang. Now this raised the question of, how do I prove I'm a clergyman? This is a world before you've got documentation and lots of records and databases and ID cards and all of that. And one answer is that I prove I'm a clergyman by proving that I can read Latin. So that became the test. And eventually it became customary to have you read a particular verse from the Bible, which was nicknamed the neck verse, because you could save your neck by memorizing that verse and thus being able to pretend to read it. Now, over time, especially after Henry VIII decided he wanted a divorce and so pulled England out of the Catholic Church, the church courts lost their ability to have very serious dealings with anything. And thus, benefit of clergy became a get-out-of-jail-free card. And in response to that, the legal system gradually declared more and more crimes to be non-clergyable. Right? The original restriction was that when you pled, or original, at some point the restriction was, you pled benefit of clergy, you were branded on the thumb, and you couldn't do it again. So it was only a one-time get-out-of-jail-free card. But eventually that was inadequate, so what they started doing was saying, you can't plead benefit of clergy for homicide. You can't for this, you can't for that. And you end up, by the time you're well into the 18th century, with all serious crimes being non-clergyable and capital. So that if you stole more than 40 shillings, that was a capital offense. If you stole property from a house under circumstances where you put the inhabitants in fear, that was a capital offense. If you stole a sheep, that was a capital offense, and so forth. And then the interesting question is, how do you deal with that system? And one answer is what was called pious perjury, which means that the jury observes that you have stolen a set of things which include 50 shillings in money, plus some other goods, and they find you guilty of stealing goods worth a total of 39 shillings. Thus, just below the cutoff to make it capital. Pious perjury, and that the jury is perjuring itself because they don't think you deserve to hang. But the other, in some ways more interesting solution, was pardoning. And there are basically three versions of pardoning. One of them is you are pardoned on condition of transportation, meaning that you agree to be transported to the New World as an indentured servant for 17 years. I think it's 70, it might be 14. Second one is pardoning on condition of enlistment. If there's a war going on, you agree to join the Army or the Navy, and they pardon you. The third is they pardon you and send you home. And so part of what intrigued me about the whole system is why they have this system where they first condemn you to hang and then send you home, or do one of the other two. And I think I have some fairly plausible answers. Now, of course, the enlistment is pretty easy. They need soldiers. And so why hang somebody when you can have him shot by the enemy instead and win the battle in the process? Transportation is a little less clear. It's arguable that they wanted indentured servants in the colonies. On the other hand, it's hard to be sure if that was really a benefit or just a way of having a penalty somewhat less severe than execution that didn't cost them much of anything. The hardest one is pardoning you and sending you home. And I have a couple of different theories about what's going on. One of them, if you think about it as sort of a modern law and econ person, there are two both intuitively and theoretically plausible models for how you set punishment. One of them is you say the punishment should be equal to the damage done. Because that way the only time people will commit crimes is in the special case where it really is more important to you. If you imagine the starving man stealing or cannibalism in shipwreck cases, the sort of situation. Judge Posner's example is a hunter lost and starving in the woods who comes on a locked cabin with inside it canned food and a telephone. And he breaks into the cabin, and under our legal system he is excused under the doctrine of necessity. But one way of having a system where people commit crimes only if the benefit to them is larger than the cost to the victim is saying the penalty will be equal to the cost to the victim, so only if your benefit is larger will you commit it. You're then sort of self-selecting. So that's one theory. An alternative theory is to say, look, locking people up is expensive. Hanging people is cheap, but those people might have families you're then going to have to support. They might have an employer who loses an employee. We'd like to use the lowest penalty that will deter somebody. So that suggests the penalty should just be a little bit more than the benefit to the criminal, and that's enough to deter the crime. And You don't know what that is, which is one reason to use the other one, but those both make some intuitive sense. The punishment to fit the crime or enough punishment to deter. So one way of reading this system is that what the judge was really saying is, this guy is a hardened criminal. If we don't hang him or at least transport him, he's going to be back. I'll see him again. This is a kid who got drunk. His friend said, wouldn't it be fun to steal a sheep? I scared him by saying, you're going to be hanging by the neck until dead. If I send him home, he'll never do it again. So that's one possible interpretation. There's a way of getting discretionary levels of punishment. Another interpretation, which I sort of like, is that you were really selling pardons, just not explicitly. Back in the Middle Ages, it was explicit. Back in the Middle Ages, you did have situations where somebody, in effect, bought a pardon from the king. But in this system, the way I like to imagine it happening is that some young man gets drunk and gets in trouble and gets condemned for sheep stealing. And his friends go to the local squire. And they say, squire, can you do something for us? You know, Bill is in trouble. You think you can help him? And the squire doesn't have enough political influence to do anything. So he goes to the local lord. And the local lord has a seat in parliament, maybe a couple of seats in parliament. And part of the reason he has seats in parliament is he's supported by the local squires who tell their people to vote for him, or for the person he tells them to vote for. And so the squire says to the lord, one of my people has gotten in trouble. You think you could do anything? And now the lord's got some political influence, and he persuades the judge to pardon him. This was pure theory. But it's a form of a market in which what you're ultimately being paid for, what the pay ultimately is the loyalty of the villagers to the squire. That the squire is doing an important favor for the villagers, so they will tell him if somebody's poaching his chickens, will vote the way he asks them to vote for parliament. They won't feel imposed upon because he's done them a favor, not the other way around. And similarly down the hierarchy with the squire is the lord is doing a favor for the squire and so forth. I then came across a real case. James Bosworth is best known as the author of the most famous biography in English, the biography of Samuel Johnson, who was a friend of his. Bosworth was a Scottish attorney. And it was discovered early in the 20th century that he had kept a set of memoirs for a large part of his life, most of which survived, and are now in print. And one of the bits in the memoirs involves two cases he was involved with as an attorney. And the first was his very first case, when there was a man who had been found with stolen sheep in his herd and was charged with sheep stealing. And Bosworth managed to get him off, managed to persuade the jury to acquit. And a little bit after he did this, a judge, commenting in another case, mentioned this case of Bosworth as a clear miscarriage of judgment, of justice, where a fast-talking young lawyer had gotten a guilty guy off. Many years later, the same man is again found with a stolen sheep in his herd, and again Bosworth defends him. And this time he is unable to get an acquittal. And the man is condemned to hang. And Bosworth starts trying to get him a pardon. And more or less moves heaven and earth to get him a pardon. Does he do it by offering evidence the man is innocent? No, no. He does it by going to all of his high-ranking, important, noble friends and asking them as a favor to him if they will write to the relevant royal authorities who on behalf of the king will pardon him. Why does he fail? Because the same judge who made that comment years ago also writes to the relevant authorities and more or less threatens to quit if they pardon this obviously guilty guy on the request of this no longer young, fast-talking lawyer. So it was quite fascinating to see a real example, not exactly what I'm describing, it is Scottish, not English, but it's under the same general political system of the pardon really being, in a certain sense, bought for political favors instead. I should say, part of what makes it familiar is that early in Bosworth's career, he wanted a commission in a royal regiment, which was basically the Royal Guard stationed in London, because he wanted to live the life of a rich young aristocrat. Unfortunately for him, his father, who was roughly the Scottish equivalent of Supreme Court justice, didn't want him to live the life of a rich young aristocrat and wasn't willing to pay for it, wanted him to become a lawyer and to work hard. And so Bosworth tries to get influence. He's the kind of guy who's very good at making friends with people, including Samuel Johnson. And so he makes friends with lots of aristocrats and tries to get them to use their influence to get him the commission he wants. But it's clear he fails. And the reason he fails is that getting a commission is a valuable political plum. You've got to pay for it. Bosworth, he has no resources. His father has resources, but his father's against it. His father's going to be mad at anybody who does it. So he fails. We would see the same sort of economy of favors running in that system as well. So much for 18th century English, but I did a long time ago an article on this, which was one of the things that got me interested in making sense of legal systems. Let me go on to something which is a little closer to modern news, and that's Somalia. Because we all hear these stories about how Somalia is a terribly anarchist system. The actual history goes as follows. Somalia was, in effect, a colony of England and Italy, northern Somalia under English, I think it was theoretically not a colony, but protectorate or something under the League of Nations originally, and southern under Italy. And in 1960, Italy and England agreed to give up their position to join the two halves and to create a new nation of Somalia. The problem was that Somalia was a stateless society. It did not have a central government. It had never had a central government. And the English and Italians knew that all proper societies had to have central governments. So they set up a democratic central government in Mogadishu. And it ran as a democracy for a few years, and there was then a military coup, and it ran as a military dictatorship rather badly for a good number more years. And then the military dictator got into a war with Ethiopia, which was sort of a traditional opponent of the Somalis. And in the course of the war, the Soviet Union decided to switch sides, decided to start backing the Ethiopians instead of the Somali. At which point the Somalia no longer had a good supply of weapons, and the Ethiopians did, and the Somali did very badly, and people in Somalia got very mad at the dictator, and he got overthrown. And there was no government. And the UN said, this is terrible, there has got to be a government in the country of Somalia, and attempted to establish a central government in Mogadishu, and they've been trying to do it ever since. And the trouble with attempting to establish a central government in Mogadishu is that after there's been a government for a while, as there had been, it becomes obvious to the Somali that if there's going to be a government, it's much better to be the governor than the governed. And the result is that they start fighting over who's going to be the central government. And that's more or less been going on ever since. This was the picture I got from a book written by a Dutch lawyer who spent the last 12 years of his life in Somalia, married to a Somali woman. And I wasn't entirely sure I trusted it because his political views were too much like mine, and I am insufficiently critical of people who agree with me. But I then located a retired English professor and anthropologist from London School of Economics who pretty clearly is the world's expert on traditional Somali institutions, which he had been writing about since the 1950s. His view is essentially the same. He thinks the UN is the villain, not the Somalis, and we ought to have left them alone. Meanwhile, in the northern part of Somalia, what was the British part, they established what they called the Republic of Somaliland, which was built largely on traditional institutions, though it did have a sort of a government, but nobody's willing to recognize them because that would be admitting Somalia wasn't one country, and we can't have that happening. Hence the present mess. What I want to talk about, however, are the traditional institutions, which were described by this guy and which existed at least until 1960 in the north, because the British ruled with a very light hand. They mostly let things go on under traditional things with a little bit of interference, which didn't work too well. One of the funny things that he describes is when we're having a feud between two groups. We attack you. We make sure the British know about the attack late enough so they can't interfere with our attacking you, but can't interfere with you counterattacking us. So it's clear, the Somalis sound like interesting people. They have a high opinion of themselves, that's clear, do not think of themselves as the second-class citizens of the world, and are perfectly willing to try to manipulate the Westerners who are trying to manipulate them. But the basic system they have is a little bit like my Icelandic system and yet different. Because it's a system based on coalitions that are partly but not entirely based on kinship. The relevant kinship is agnatic kinship, kinship through the male line, although kinship through the female line ends up playing a secondary role under some circumstances. But what's basically happening is that you have a group which my source refers to as the Dia-paying group. Dia is actually the Arabic term for the Icelandic wergeld, the payment for killing or injuring somebody. But the English administrators who were using the term had experience in the Arab world and were therefore transferring the term. But what the Dia-paying group is a group of people who will share the payment of the blood penalty if one of their members kills somebody or injures somebody, and will share the duty of extracting the payment if one of their members is killed or injured. So it's a coalition to enforce the members' rights and to make sure that if the members violate rights, the penalty is paid. And it is a contractual coalition. There is an explicit contract saying how the burdens will be shared, so that you will have subgroups within the Dia-paying groups, so-called GIFO-paying groups, where the rule might be if a member of my GIFO-paying group commits a killing, the GIFO-paying group owes a third of the fine, and the other two-thirds will be shared among the other members of the Dia-paying group. That would be a possible rule, but the exact rule would depend on the contract of the group. How are the groups formed? By a combination of contractual association and agnatic kinship, so that you are more likely to be in a coalition with people who are all the descendants of the same grandfather, say, or the same great-grandfather. But you don't actually have to, and you might have one group that's descendants of one great-grandfather and another that's another that have agreed to be part of the same Dia-paying group in order to get enough people to be able to both share expenses and successfully enforce feuds. And the Somali have a term for a group like a Dia-paying group which isn't structured on kinship. Because if you don't have enough kin and you need to have a reasonable number of people to make this work, you could just find allies. This is referred to as a pile of shields. It is the term that the Somali used to describe the British Commonwealth and the U.S. alliance against the Soviets. Those were both piles of shields. They were coalitions, the equivalent on a larger scale of a Dia-paying group, seen in their terms, but it wasn't a really proper Dia-paying group because it wasn't based on kinship. And there's a quote from one Somali that in Somalia, your genealogy is what your address is in Europe. That in Europe, if you live in France, you're a Frenchman and you're expected to pay taxes to the French and to join the French army. If you live in Germany, you're a German. In Somalia, everybody has memorized his genealogy for 20 generations up. And your connection to somebody is determined by how far up there you have a common male ancestor, common ancestor in the male line. So that what happens is, if I'm having a conflict with somebody who shares my great-great-grandfather, who had two sons, one of whom I'm descended from and one of whom he's descended from, the descendants of this son are likely to be my allies and the descendants of that son are likely to be his allies. But then, when one of us gets into a conflict with somebody who's connected, now the two of our groups coalesce because we're all agnatic kin relative to him and work against him. So it's a sort of a fluid system of coalitions. Whereas the Icelandic one, you have coalitions which are entirely, well, they're immediate family, parent and child, but other than that, they're a matter of who are friends, basically. And the Somali, it's partly who are friends, but it's partly this elaborate structure of sort of pre-made coalitions defined by relationship. So it really is, in that sense, to me, quite a fascinating system. And they then have arrangements for arbitrating disputes to avoid actually killing each other, so that when a dispute arises, the senior members of the two groups get together as a court, and they get an arbitrator, and they settle, and they reach a settlement. And if you can't reach a settlement, you end up fighting. It's a feud system. But presumably most of the time, there's a system of traditional law, not a legislature, but like the Roman Child Gypsies, people know what the rules more or less are, and the arbitrator rules, and if people don't think the arbitrator's ruling fits traditional law, they don't ask him to arbitrate again. So it's a less formal, whereas the Icelandic system, you have an explicit legislature and law code, this is more like a system of norms, but again, it's a system of norms being enforced by the threat of violence, but with the actual violence largely prevented through court kinds of arbitration mechanisms to reach accounts. So that struck me as on the whole quite interesting. One of the bits that I thought was interesting was a point at which there was a lot of violence between two clans, and they didn't like it. So what did they do? They raised the weregeld. They agreed that when somebody was killed, the payment in camels would be higher than it used to be. That makes it more expensive to kill people. Right? Remember my bit in Iceland about, we'll break up the fight before you've killed more people than you can afford. And that's presumably the same spirit that you're seeing in the Somali system. So it was actually quite an interesting system. It's not at all clear that, I think it's pretty clear that it worked better than the military dictatorship did, as far as one can tell. Arguably, it's working better now in the places far from Mogadishu, but around Mogadishu, they're still fighting over who's going to be the government, and we and the Ethiopians and the UN are still encouraging them to do so by trying to support somebody or other who will claim to be the government of Somalia. All right, I think that gets me through all of the systems that I wanted to discuss. And I wanted to go on to discuss one of the general threat issues. Yes?
How did the Somali pirates fit into...
I don't know. They're modern. That is, they're based. What's happened at this point is that most of the northern chunk is Republic of Somaliland. The northeastern corner, whose name I forget, regards itself as a semi-independent province of the country of Somalia. And I think that's where the pirates are based, but I'm not sure. The issue I wanted to talk about, I'm not sure if it's worth the trouble, but there was something I was thinking of trying to find on here, is... just one moment, and I will... There's just a Latin quote I want to show you, because it has an interesting history to it. There we are. There's my webpage. And if I go down my webpage to my books... What? You want to turn on the light? No. I then mention the book I'm working on, which I hope you will all read if you find it interesting, because that's got more details of what I've been doing. But the particular thing in my thread chapters was this one, and I wanted to give you that quote. Quis custodia ipsos custodis? Who is to guard the guardians? Does anybody know the original context of that? Because I didn't until I looked it up. The original context of that has nothing to do with police or law. It has to do with the problem of a husband trying to keep his wife faithful. It's from one of the, from Juvenal, I think, from one of the Roman writers, and he's talking about how the husband will set people to guard his wife. The plan that my friends always advise me to adopt, bolder in constrainer, but who can watch the watchman? They keep quiet about the girl's secrets and get her as their payment. Everyone hushes it up. It's juvenile. But it's usual. What struck me about that when I discovered that is that I knew the same story with a different final ending by an English 18th century poet called Matthew Prior. It's a poem I'm quite fond of. And the poem is called The English Padlock. And the poem is essentially Juvenal's problem. It's a jealous husband talking to his friend about the more and more extreme methods he's going to use to make sure his wife is going to stay faithful, and the friend explaining why none of them is going to work. And finally, the husband says, is there anything I can do? And he says, yes. Send her abroad, meaning out of the house, and let her see that all this mingled mask that she, being forbidden, longs to know is a vain mask, an empty show, powder and pocket glass and bow, a tissue of romance and lies, false tears and real perjuries, where love is made but to be told. When she flies from this, let all her ways be unconfined and set your padlock on her mind. Hence the English padlock. It's quite a neat poem. I once wrote a takeoff on it because I encountered this poem in a course on 18th century poetry, taught by a professor at Chicago when I was a graduate student in physics. And that professor, as it happened, was the chairman of the committee of the Council of the Faculty Senate the year there was a student uprising in Chicago. And so I took a takeoff on this as advice on how to deal with it, namely turn over the university to the students, and when they get sick and tired of trying to run it and having everything go wrong, agree to come back if they will be sufficiently nice to you, which amused him. He was a good course. He was a very good professor. It was a very good course. Anyway, that's why I remember it. One reason I remember the poem. But I thought it was amusing that that people always use the phrase in the political context, which is my subject, of course, but that's where it originated. So the basic problem that I'm raising is you have some mechanism for enforcing the law. How do we enforce the law against the enforcers? And that's a problem all systems solve, all systems have. And the simplest solution is that there are no specialized enforcers. If you think about a system of norms or a feud system, everyone's equal. No one has any rights anybody else doesn't have. If you behave in ways I think outrageous, I gossip about you, or I don't associate with you, or I don't invite you to my bridge parties, or whatever the norm enforcement mechanisms are in that society, you can do the same thing to me. No one has any special rights. We're all constrained in the same way. A feud system is the same thing on a larger scale, where if I try to extort wealth from you by threatening to kill you if you don't pay me, well, you can sue me and you can get your allies together and have a feud against me just like in any other case. So there you don't have any specialized enforcers. So that's one possibility. Another possibility, and one that's popular in lots of systems instead of ours, is you have a second layer. You have your police, and then you have your civilian review board. The best story I know on that is by H.L. Mencken. Mencken is discussing the question of he's not thinking about police in particular, but how do you discipline government officials? And he says the Prussians had a solution to this problem. That the Prussians had a special set of courts for trying officials who were charged with malfeasance. Now he says in Prussia this worked. Because it was the view of a Prussian judge that if you were brought before him, you were guilty. To deny that would be an insult to the Kaiser. But he says it would never work in America, because the judge would be a member of the same gang of rogues as the defendant, and so would let him off. So Mencken says we need a uniquely American solution to this problem. And the solution is self-help. That if you are wronged by a government official, you are entitled to punishment. And it is then up to him or his heirs to demonstrate that the punishment was greater than he deserved and that you therefore deserve or ought to pay back the difference, so to speak. Mencken is a lot of fun if you haven't read him. He and Chesterton are two of my favorite essayists. But in any case, let me go on to some real-world examples. Imperial China, as I've mentioned, I think, before, they invented the civil service exam. It was this elaborate literary examination, which almost everybody could take. The people who got the almost highest scores became district magistrates, and the people who got the highest scores became censors. And censor doesn't mean what we mean by it. The censor was the office for investigating the magistrates. So that the very smartest young officials at the beginning of their career had the job of going around from district to district, finding out whether the government officials were corrupt or not. So that was one explicit way of trying to do that. In the Islamic system, under the caliph, there would be an office for the investigation of complaints. Which was serving essentially the same function. But of course, given that system, that just pushes the problem one step further up, because now how do we enforce the rules against the censor if they're corrupt, against the civilian review board if they're really in the pockets of the police, and so forth and so on. Another approach, which is not quite the same but it's related, is you have different parts of the legal system which can enforce against each other. So that once in a while in the U.S., the FBI accuses the chief of police of some town of doing various illegal things. So that's one way in which we do it. A more interesting variant, I was talking with one of my colleagues in the law school, and he commented that if you look at law texts in the 19th century, that the modern law text discusses the question, if you're a policeman, of what you have to do in order that the evidence you get won't be thrown out. All right, the exclusionary rule. The equivalent in the 19th century cases, before the exclusionary rule exists, was what you have to do in order that you won't get sued. because it was assumed that police officers, like anybody else, were subject to civil suit, and therefore, if you broke the law in doing a search, you could potentially get sued for it. To some extent, this existed other times and places. Part of what got me interested in the whole question of civil versus criminal, figure tort versus criminal law, was a case when I was a graduate student in Chicago involving the Black Panthers. A group of police came to the door of an apartment full of sleeping Black Panthers early in the morning and opened fire and killed two people. They claimed that the Panthers had shot first. The Panthers said no. I mentioned this to a friend who was politically much farther left than I was. And I said, basically, I'm perfectly willing to believe the police are lying. I'm equally willing to believe the Panthers are lying. I don't trust either of them. And she said, well, the Panthers are offering tours of the apartment if you'd like to see the evidence. It turns out that when a bullet goes through a wall, you can tell which direction it's going, but which way the splinters are facing, and all of the bullet holes were incoming. There was never any evidence produced that the Panthers had fired anything. No policeman was ever charged with murder, which they were pretty clearly guilty of, even manslaughter. One of the district attorneys involved was charged with obstruction of justice but acquitted. But the city, county, and state paid several hundred thousand dollars in civil settlements to the surviving Black Panthers. And that struck me as an interesting case because it suggests that one of the problems with criminal law is that you can't use it against the government because it's the government that has to charge people. Civil law, you can. There was... Yep.
Well, a question on that in the 21st century.
Yes.
What is your opinion on capital punishment of homicides? Do you believe in a jury of your peers, or do you believe in a professional jury? Or a young, fast copy young lawyer?
Yeah, of course, you don't really have a jury of your peers anyway, given what determines who ends up on a jury. But the answer is I don't really have an opinion on how better to run a jury system. It's not something I've studied. I doubt there's a good way of doing any of these things, and which is the least bad way is that's not in my professional expertise. Let me go on, though. There was another more recent case involving Steve Jackson Games, which is a company that makes role-playing games and computer games and such. And there were some federal law enforcement people who were trying to hunt down computer crime and were pretty incompetent at it. And they came across a computer which had what was in fact the handbook for a role-playing game on future computer crime that Steve Jackson Games was producing. They concluded that it was an instruction manual for committing computer crime and seized... Oh, they did a surprise search and seizure of Steve Jackson Games and seized all copies of the manuscript, computerized and physical. This happens to be a violation of federal law, that Steve Jackson Games is a publisher, and you cannot do a seizure in advance of publication of a book except under very restrictive circumstances, none of which were met. Steve Jackson's lawyers pointed this out to the Secret Service like 2 days later. It took something like 6 months for them to get their manuscripts back. And they sued and won in a Texas court and collected damages from the Secret Service in Texas for violation. Now, they didn't collect nearly as much damage as they should have. I think the judge was treating it more as a symbolic one. On the other hand, nobody went to jail. I don't know whether it was a criminal offense or not, but clearly it was, I think, fairly clear that the Secret Service not only violated federal law to start with, they kept violating it for some 6 months or so after it was pointed out to them. So, let me go back, however, to the 18th century. Because it turns out that part of the basis for our Constitution is a case of this sort in the 18th century. The case is called Hinkle v. Money, and it involves a anti-government publication called the North British Inquirer, I think, which was run by the man who the assassin of Lincoln was named after. Who's the assassin of Lincoln? John Wilkes Booth. Who is John Wilkes? The man that Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania is named after. John Wilkes was a journalist and politician in England who in the course of his career was at various points a prisoner in the Tower an outlaw in Europe, Lord Mayor of London, and a member of Parliament. He fought a long feud, a long war with the King of England, and basically won. And at one stage in this feud, he was running a hostile-to-the-government publication, which said some very unkind things about a speech the king had made. And the government didn't like it. And they sent out king's messengers, who were their equivalent of Secret Service agents, with a blank warrant, with a warrant to arrest anybody and seize any property that they believed to be connected to this subversive publication. And they arrested, I don't remember how many, 35 people or so. And one of them sued. And he sued on the grounds that blank warrants were contrary to the unwritten Constitution of England. And he won. And he collected damages from the Secretary of State. And this is, in some sense, the basis of the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, because this established the principle in English law before the Constitution that you, in order to have a search, you had to specifically name what you were searching and why, and that's the guts of the Fourth Amendment. So John Wilkes, I should say at a different point in his career, John Wilkes was also generally in debt. He was profligate, he wanted to be generous, he wasn't very rich. And at one point, the legislature of the colony of, I think, North Carolina contributed some substantial sum to a fund to pay his debts. And the English government sent a message to the governor of North Carolina, stop this nonsense, they're subsidizing the bad guy. And the governor told the legislature not to send the money, and the result was that the government of South Carolina, I think it was North Carolina, was shut, or maybe it was all Carolina then, I'm not sure, was shut down for a couple of years because the legislature and the governor couldn't agree. An interesting and crazy figure. He was supposed to be the ugliest man in England, but also one of the most charismatic. He was a friend of Boswell's, incidentally, who had very different political views, but liked him a lot. Wilkes is supposed to have said that although he was the ugliest man in England, he could defeat the handsomer man in England for a woman's favor given 2 hours head start. Different versions of it, but something like that. Yeah, that's right. Anyway, so... So that's an interesting example of a different approach in which you're using one part of the legal system, the civil law, to control another part. Final suggestion for the modern world is the implication of surveillance technology, of the surveillance technology each of you has in your pocket, namely your cell phone with a video camera on it. That there's an interesting book called The Transparent Society by David Grin, who's a science fiction author, who is arguing that the way things are moving, we're going to have a future in which everything that happens in public is video recorded and findable. And that's pretty scary. And the only way of making it less scary is for the transparency to go in both directions. So the cops can watch us, but we can watch them. And now, there are clearly limitations to that, because they can arrest us and we can't arrest them. But I think the Rodney King case suggests that Brin has got a real point, that to the extent that the technology means that you can have clear records of misdeeds by law enforcement, that makes it more possible to control it. There's an old version of the same idea. And that's the idea that in sort of traditional systems such as Islamic caliphates, a sensible sultan or caliph had an open court. That once a day or once a week, there was a court that anybody could come to in order to bring complaints to him about the misdeeds of his officials. And somebody, I think Richard Burton, who did the famous translation of The Thousand Nights and a Night, the real Richard Burton, not the actor who's named after him, famous, weird, interesting, late 19th century figure, I think writes somewhere that it was the downfall of each Muslim dynasty when it stopped having open court, and that after a while, whoever was the gatekeeper became the ruler, de facto. But the trouble is all of this depends on some superior power that doesn't want the officials to do misdeeds, and therefore will punish them when it's discovered. So if you imagine that the people at the top are on the same side as the police officials are doing misdeeds, it doesn't do any good to produce the evidence. They'll just ignore it. But nonetheless, that is one of the ways. Let me go on the general question of sort of of preventing misdeeds to my particular brief against the TSA. I believe I can prove that the Transportation Safety Agency, as it calls itself, does not care if its employees steal your property, and indeed would prefer not to know. What is my evidence for that? My evidence is that when they search your suitcase, they leave a note. That note could easily enough identify the agent who searched it. If your luggage is searched in San Francisco Airport, which is run not by TSA, but subcontracted to a private firm, the note has a number on it identifying who searched it. If it's searched by TSA, it doesn't. That is a very inexpensive precaution. It would make it much riskier to steal stuff from suitcases, which happens, on my evidence. It would make it much riskier to engage in deliberate vandalism of suitcases, which also happens, on my evidence. But it would mean that the TSA would have to investigate cases, and they would prefer not to. So I think that's pretty clearly a case where, because the people at the top of that organization don't, in fact, want to prevent their people, or don't care if their people engage in misdeeds, that therefore it does no good, and they choose not to seal. All right, let me go on to a sort of a final summary of what I hope comes out of this process in the book and my investigations. And that is that other societies at other times and places provide interesting examples of legal systems. They're ones we ought to take seriously. There's no reason to believe that we're smarter than, you know, Aristotle and Plato and Pericles and a bunch of other people in other legal systems. One of the interesting things about those systems is that once you've seen them, you can recognize features of our system that might not have occurred to you. So that, for example, after you look at how feud systems work, you understand better not only systems of private norms in our legal system, which are really a sort of a low-key feud system, but also patent wars in our present legal system, which I think are also a low-key feud system, if I understand them correctly. After you think about how Jewish law and Islamic law deal with working around laws set by God, you can make more sense of how our legal system deals with the Constitution, which sometimes is inconvenient because it forbids things the government wants to do. When you've looked at how polylegal systems exist and resolve conflicts, that helps you make more sense out of our legal system, where we have state law and law of the circuit and diversity jurisdiction and a whole bunch of other things, which are really our attempts to solve that same set of problems. And having looked at the different ways in which different societies try to control the enforcers, try to quis custodiat ipsos custodes, that at least gives you some ideas of how we might do it, why it might or might not work, and so forth. So that's part of it, is making sense of our own system. Part of it is ideas that might be useful for our system, ideas that we could use. So that I discussed with regard to Icelandic system the fact that tort claims were marketable or transferable, and I suggested that our legal system might work better if you couldn't afford a lawyer or didn't know what lawyer to trust. You could simply sell your claim to whatever law firm offered the highest price for it and then let them prosecute the claim. Similarly, I was discussing today how in the Athenian system, the losing plaintiff under some circumstances owed damages to the prevailing defendant. That would have a number of virtues in our system. It would discourage suing people when you think they probably are innocent, but with luck you can get them to settle for something out of court, or maybe persuade a jury they're guilty when they aren't. It would discourage, if you use the Athenian system, where the damages were proportioned to the claims by the plaintiff, it would discourage overclaiming. It would mean that you wouldn't have the pattern of, well, I really think it's only $100,000, but I'm going to claim $1 million, because you would be at risk of losing more than $100,000 if you lost. So I think all of that is interesting. I've discussed the pre-commitment to prosecute in English 18th century law as a way of making deterrence to a private good. We have a little bit of that in our system. I think the American Automobile Association still gives you a sticker to put on your car which says they will pay a reward to somebody who reports this car stolen. so that you can say, you can imagine other ways in which you might be able to implement more of that in our system as ways of making it in the private interest of people to take actions to catch criminals in order to deter crimes. The system of Imperial China, of having the very highest status officials being the ones whose job was catching the other ones, suggests things you might imagine doing in our system. I'm not quite sure how you would implement it. The Amish provide some interesting ideas, in particular the idea of a community deliberately choosing what technology does or doesn't fit what it's doing. And you can certainly imagine outside of the Amish just setting up a proprietary community. And a little bit of that happens. My parents used to own property at Sea Ranch, north of San Francisco, and they were not allowed to plant plants that weren't of varieties native to that area, because part of the idea of Sea Ranch was to maintain a sort of a consistent background. And you can think of carrying that much further if you believe that certain technologies result in a society you don't like. Get together with people who agree with you and have a society that doesn't permit those. And I think the Amish also provides some evidence that our schooling system isn't as great as we think it is, given that they managed to do pretty well with a very different, much simpler schooling system. Finally, let me warn you not to believe anything I say, that I cannot be an expert in all the things I've been studying. I am surely, in some cases, oversimplifying. There are probably cases where I have the facts wrong. I'm telling you the truth as I believe it, but one should never be too confident on any source of information, and should certainly never trust any source of information that tells you to be confident. Thank you.